good morning, and thank you very much for having me back. And I will second the motion in terms of what was said about Marjorie and all of her work. She is on the ball. I work with synagogues and organizations and schools around the city, and it's rare to have somebody who responds to emails on time, sends you notice in advance, makes sure that everything is said and that you know all the details. She's really very dedicated to making this a success, and I want to thank you as well. So I thought that for a year-end topic, I would take something that has a blend of history, philosophy, even a little bit of Jewish law in it, with this topic that you see titled on your sheet as dressing up, dressing down from tzitzit to the yellow star. For me, it's a fascinating topic. So I figure let's see what we can do with this. If you take a look at the first source on your sheet, this is, I think, the necessary opening. It's from the year 1215, as you see listed there. It's from the Catholic Church's Fourth Lateran Council. And it's the text that ordered that Jews would have to wear a particular article of clothing. In some provinces, it says, a difference in dress distinguishes the Jews or Saracens from the Christians, right? Saracens are Muslims, correct? So in some provinces, there's a difference in dress between Jews or Muslims and Christians. But in certain others, such a confusion has grown up that they cannot be distinguished by any difference. You can't tell the difference between them. Thus, it happens at times that through error, Christians have relations with the women of Jews or Saracens, and Jews and Saracens with Christian women. So the church is worried about what's going on, this mingling of Christians with non-Christians. Therefore, this really is a strong mic. Okay. Therefore, that they may not, under pretext of error of this sort, excuse themselves in the future for the excesses of such prohibited intercourse, we decree that such Jews and Saracens of both sexes in every Christian province and at all times shall be marked off in the eyes of the public from other peoples through the character of their dress. So, in order to make sure that any Christians can't say, we didn't know she was Jewish, we didn't know he was Muslim, we're going to make sure that Jews and Muslims all have to wear a special garment that will identify them as not being Christian. And then they add this very interesting note, which we're going to have to come back to. Particularly, it says, since it may be read in the writings of Moses that this very law has been enjoined upon them. It's part of the laws of Moses that Jews should have to wear something that marks them as separate from non-Jews. What in the world are they talking about? Tzitzit. No, not circumcision. For those who were not clear on this, that one doesn't involve clothing. Yeah, no, we're actually talking about tzitzit. For those who will be in synagogues... For those who will be in, someone asked me when I came in if I had jokes ready. I didn't need to. The material writes itself. But it's actually in this week's Torah portion, the portion of Shlach, at the very end of it, we have indeed the commandment of tzitzit, the idea that a four-cornered garment should have strings hanging from it. We'll talk more about it a little bit later. But they're saying, well, after all, the Torah says that the Jews have a special garment, so it's not a big reach for us to say that we're going to create a special garment they will wear that will separate them from everyone else. And then they add, moreover, during the last 3 days before Easter, and especially on Good Friday, they shall not go forth in public at all. For the reason that some of them on these very days, as we hear, do not blush to go forth better dressed, and are not afraid to mock the Christians who maintain the memory of the most holy passion by wearing signs of mourning. The Jews are not grieving, imagine that, during that period of time. And there's more. I only brought you a piece of Canon 68, this decree. There's quite a bit more there. What's the goal of the badge? What are they trying to accomplish? Separating Jews from, or Jews and Muslims from Christians. There's actually more to it in terms of their goals we're going to have to talk about. But what I want to do for much of our time is to talk about the goal of the badge, where it came from, how it was practiced, how it impacted the Jews, and ultimately what it's going to say about Jewish history and Judaism as we've evolved. So first of all, interesting to realize the idea of a badge marking Jews as separate from others did not begin with the church. It actually began with Islam. They're the ones who had it first, and it goes all the way back to the Pact of Umar in the 7th century. This was their set of laws for those who would live under them. Take a look at number 2, please, where I brought you the relevant text. The Pact of Umar decrees, we shall show respect toward the Muslims. This is supposed to be the voice of the person who has accepted to live under Muslim control without being a Muslim. That's the idea, is if you're going to live in their society, you have to say the following. We shall show respect toward the Muslims, and we shall rise from our seats when they wish to sit. Oh, it's like on the subway. We shall not seek to resemble the Muslims by imitating any of their garments, and they list certain garments, the kalansua, which is a turban, footwear, or the parting of the hair. I don't know, they had a special haircut, I guess. We shall not speak as they do, nor shall we adopt their kunyas, which are nicknames and special titles. We shall always dress in the same way wherever we may be, and we shall bind the zunar around our waists. The zunar is a belt. Interestingly, there's also a requirement, which I didn't bring here, but it also involved the wearing of yellow. The zunar was supposed to be a broad yellow belt. Anybody know why yellow? It's not a reflector at night. That's not the idea. Humiliation. Sorry. Distinctive. Not all McDonald's are red and yellow, you should know. I read an article on that just a couple of weeks ago. There's a very interesting email put out by a fellow by the name of Dan Lewis. It's called Now You Know or Now We Know or something like that. And every day he has these very strange things that he sends out. And there was one about apparently there are a couple of places where, thanks to local regulations for signs, they can't do that. Instead of blue instead of yellow. One of them is out in Arizona because it's in Mesa, Arizona, I think, because of the background. Whatever, we're getting further afield. In any case, the yellow is visible, this is true, but that's not the reason, yeah?
What is a gartel?
What is a gartel? So, I like Jeopardy. The right answer, no. A gartel is a belt, generally black, although technically it doesn't have to be. It's often done as a cord, and it's worn by many during prayer specifically, during davening. And the reason for the gartel is the idea of separating the lower and upper parts of the body, the idea being that the lower part of the body below the belt is more animal, and then you get up to the heart and the brain, and they're different. There's also an idea, there are more ideas than that. That's one element of it, but I don't think that's what's going on here. I don't believe so, no. Yeah?
Is it also worn during Pesach?
The gartel, you mean, or the zunar? The gartel, you mean. So it generally is associated with prayer, specifically. Even daily. Oh, the Seder? Could be. Mm-hmm. Possible. Yeah?
I think it's the color of urine.
So would yellow be associated with urine? That's an interesting idea. So I'm going to suggest where it is. Yeah. One more and then I'm going to go further. Yeah. Right, today yellow has an element of cowardice. Interestingly though, it appears that among at least early Muslims, they viewed it as a sign of being primitive. So there was a ban against painting mosques with yellow, for example. Islam in general had highly regulated rules for artwork, some of which stem from Judaism. So, for example, they would not paint the human form. When you look at early Muslim art, and still today in some countries, it's very much geometric patterns as opposed to images of people or even animals. And that's something they took from us. But the idea of yellow was that it meant you're primitive. And so the non-Muslim, this wasn't about Jews per se, but the non-Muslim would wear the belt that would identify them as being primitive. We find that moving forward within history in Muslim lands, in the year 807, the Caliph Harun al-Rashid ordered that Jews should wear a yellow belt and a tall cone-like hat. There was a Sicilian ruler by the name of Ibrahim who introduced the idea of a badge specifically for Jews and Christians, but it had a particular shape. By the way, when I'm doing all of this, I recognize that in the world in which we live today, you can't escape from the sense of, well, this is what the Muslims did then, and what about Muslims today, and Christians then, and Christians today. I'm not intending any sort of statement about relations today. I think that's far more complicated and requires its own discussion, and not simply a porting of, this is what happened in the 13th century, and therefore this relates to today. It's a lot more complicated than that. But I say that even as I tell you that the badge began with a Muslim ruler, Ibrahim, in Sicily. And he said that Christians had to display a cloth in the shape of a pig and Jews in the shape of a monkey. Indeed. In 1005, the Jews in Egypt were told that they had to wear a badge which would actually be made out of wood, and it was in the shape of a calf. As in the golden calf. As in the mark of the sin of the Jews. Fascinating. Well, it's fascinating also. It displays a level of erudition, at least. You know, that they're taking images from Jewish tradition in order to come up with our badge for the golden calf. Well, when you get to the Catholics, they had various reasons for wanting to do this. It wasn't only about marking Jews as being apart from them, but they had additional reasons. Remember that when you get to medieval Christianity, the church is very into stamping out heresy and getting everyone to see the light of their faith. So, for example, this is a period of time when they implement the forced sermon. The forced sermon is not what goes on during services Saturday morning, where they lock the doors and say, okay, at this point you can't leave. The forced sermon was on Sunday morning, and the Jews were required to attend church and listen to a sermon that was meant to get them to convert, whether because you saw the logic or because you just wanted out. One way or another, you'd have to sit there and listen to a harangue from the local priest. That was what went on. So in this period of time, you find this papal legislation, and not just the badge, but ultimately it leads to the ghetto as well. It's part of the sermon policy. You find legislation geared towards converting Jews and getting Jews not to convert and influence Christians. That's what they're trying to accomplish with this. There's an element of subjection, as in you're beneath us. There's an element of degradation to say you're forced to wear this badge and that's going to identify you. And that's really what drives this imperative, and particularly then when the church is becoming more bold because they have succeeded in defeating some of their own internal heresies. And now they're looking externally. The key figure in bringing this into the church was a pope with the ironic name of Innocent III. Innocent III was the pope from 1198 to the year 1216. He was considered a learned man. He was also a very zealous man. And he believed that the Jews are to blame for not believing in, not accepting Christian teachings. He said we should not be persecuted, though, because we are living witnesses to the truth of Christianity. One of their major points that they used to bring against Jews was, you know that God doesn't like you, because after all, you lost and we won. If God really liked you, there would be millions and millions and millions of you. And there aren't. Clearly, God has sided against you. If you're at all familiar with a work called the Kuzari. The Kuzari is written in Spain in the 11th century by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, living in Muslim Spain. And a lot of it is a response to Islamic teaching and to Christian teaching, and in particular to this point of, if God likes you, why doesn't he treat you better? Which isn't an entirely irrational question. Right? We ask that question all the time. But we don't like it when other people ask that question. That's the difference. We're very good at mocking ourselves, but we stop with that. But the Kuzari, this book, the subtitle of it is In Defense of the Despised People. Because that's how we were viewed. So this Pope, Innocent III, says, we don't want to stamp out the Jews. Their very existence testifies to the superiority of Christianity. But we're going to do things to make them demonstrate their inferiority. In the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215, he introduces the badge. Now, there were actually Jews who tried to prevent this. They sent delegations to prevent this from happening, but they failed, as you see in Canon 68 that we read in source number 1. So the goal of the badge, we know. They want to prevent this interaction between Jews and Christians that's stated in Canon 68, but it's also the papal philosophy of wanting to encourage conversion to Christianity and to show that the Jews are degraded. However, there's another element that you shouldn't forget. There's an added bonus here. Guess who made the badges? No, the Christians. And guess what you had to do? You had to buy the badge. You had to buy the badge, precisely. So it's a moneymaker, in addition to all the other elements. This has always been this way. When they would censor Jewish books as well, the Jews had to pay the censor to censor their books. This was always done that way. So, and they said we were good at business. So the badge progresses in fits and starts. It doesn't quite go that smoothly for the church. Enforcement was local, and therefore it varied by locale. Take a look at source number 3 from Cecil Roth, who did a lot on this in History of the Jews. Actually, before we get to number 3, I'm not quite there yet. I had another source that I thought I put on here, but I guess I did not. But from a work called Jewish Life in the Middle Ages, where they speak about how the size, the shape, the color, the character of the badge was left up to local government. Sometimes the local government actually allowed the Jews to choose their own. That was relatively rare. But what would happen is the church would make the decree and then order the local government to carry it out, but the local government didn't necessarily want to carry it out. Because if you carried this out, you persecuted the local Jewish population, what that often did was cause the Jews to look for somewhere else to live. And they didn't want the Jews to leave. Why didn't they want the Jews to leave?
It was basically financial.
Remember, I think we may have talked about this on other occasions. People ask the question of why Jews went into money lending. So there's a standard explanation, which is we couldn't own land and we couldn't enter various trades, which was true at various times in our history. But there was a more fundamental reason for why. Brains may have had something to do with it. But no, that's not for the most part what's going on. What's going on is, yeah.
They weren't allowed to buy the church to collect the money, to charge interest.
Right. See, there's a biblical law that says that Jews are not allowed to lend and charge interest to other Jews. Lending money without charging interest has another term for it in economics. It's called suicide. Because it doesn't work. Fundamentally, if you lend money in an interest-free loan, your best scenario is you get paid back on time, in which case all you've lost is inflation and opportunity cost, because you could have used that money, you could have invested it in something all along. So in your best case scenario, you lose. And in your nightmare scenario, the person doesn't pay back, you have to go after them, bring them to court, and ultimately they default. So lending without charging interest is not a good idea for you. Why is it done at all? Tzedakah. It's philanthropic. It's for you to say, somebody needs a hand. There's a farmer who doesn't have the capital to be able to buy seed, right, or to hire workers, so I'm going to give him a loan. At the end of the season, he'll pay me back when he has his harvest. It's necessary for society for people to have credit and loans. And this is something that's considered tzedakah, for someone to do it. So the Torah says, we're not going to make you do this for everybody, because you will go broke, and there will be no lending, and what you'll have is the financial crisis of whatever it was, 10, 15 years ago, where no one was lending. We're not going to do that, but for family, we expect you to lend money and not charge interest as a form of tzedakah, as a form of helping out. Well, the church, and then the Muslims, took this from us. And the church said, you're not allowed to lend money to another Christian and charge interest. And Islam took it as well and said, you can't lend money to another Muslim. So the problem is, though, if all you're doing is interest-free loans, you know, there's a limit to what you're going to do. Because really, as I said, economically, this is very difficult. And so what happened was, for the first couple of centuries, Christians would borrow from Muslims, and Muslims would borrow from Christians. But then you hit the Crusades. And now you're out of luck. Because how do you finance your war? The Muslims aren't going to finance the Christian side. The Christians are not going to finance the Muslim side. And so Jews end up as moneylenders. That's the way it works. Because we're the ones who can actually lend them the money for it. And Shakespeare gets a play out of it. But the point is that if you're relying on having Jews with capital in your community, you don't want to make it difficult for them to live there. And so the church issues a decree and says, Jews have to wear the badge. And the local government says, you don't tell anybody, we won't tell anybody. And that's the way we get by in various jurisdictions. As a matter of fact, that was what led to the church creating the Franciscan and Dominican orders of monks. The goal of creating these orders was that they would become, essentially, the enforcement arm of the church. They would go from place to place during the Inquisition and carry out what the church wanted carried out when local rulers had no interest in actually following through. So what you find is sort of spotty enforcement of this down through the ages, unless you had a ruler who needed to carry it out for personal reasons. Take a look at source number 3 now from Cecil Roth, History of the Jews of Italy. He talks about this issue of leaders, political leaders, who needed to enforce the badge to demonstrate their allegiance. He says, this was the case above all with the Emperor Frederick II of, I don't know how to pronounce that. You said it. Okay. He was the Holy Roman Emperor in that period, King of Sicily and so on. He was, as has been seen, a man of exceptional culture and breadth of outlook, so much so as to draw suspicion upon him in that generally unenlightened age. He found it absolutely necessary, therefore, to vindicate his orthodoxy in matters which were to him of minor importance, and the Jews were the victims. So he says, I need to prove that I am a firm Christian, and the way I'm going to do it is by abusing the Jews. Because then everybody will see, oh, he is a good Christian after all. That was his method. There were certain exemptions, interestingly. So we have records of Jewish physicians in the 16th century being exempted from the badge. I gave you an example of it in source number 4. A fellow by the name of Samuel Sarfati, who was appointed by the Pope as a physician and was freed from having to wear the badge. Particular musicians were exempted. Salomo de Rossi would be one of them in the 17th century in Italy. He was exempted from having to wear the badge. Certain Jewish merchants in Vienna were exempted as well. The styles of badge varied. It wasn't necessarily even a badge. I gave you a picture, number 5, of the Judenhut, a hat which was worn. Sometimes the badge was round in particular. Why would it be round? Yeah, why a round badge in particular? Because it often was. Oh, around the world. There's an idea. Money. So often it was about money. As in to say, these Jews are hungry for money, so we're going to have them wear a badge that resembles a coin. Alternatively, because of the Judas reference. Judas accepts cash to turn him in, so therefore we are like Judas and we have to get a badge of money. Or alternatively, It was actually meant to resemble a communion wafer, which is interesting. There were also some places where they would have the Muslims wear a crescent for Islam, and then we would have to wear something representing the full moon. But it wasn't always this way. In England, in the year 1275, it was decreed that we had to wear two tablets. Two tablets. Yes, to represent the luchot of the tablets that Moses brought down from Sinai. That's correct. In 1222, the Jews of Italy are ordered to wear a badge that had a blue color to it. Anybody know why? Tehillet, exactly. From the tzitzit strings, one string is supposed to be blue, right? That's seeing a resurgence today. It is believed in some circles that they've discovered the origin of this blue dye that was used in Talmudic times, and therefore some actually have restored that to tzitzit, but they had us wear it. They had us have to wear a bluish badge. In 1257, the Papal States required women to wear two blue stripes on head coverings. So that would be their marker as a Jew. All sorts of differences over time in different communities. Some of them, I don't know what the rationale would have been. In 1360, Jews in Rome had to wear short red coats. I can't figure that one. Yes?
My question is, why didn't the Jews go after the Christians in the same manner as the Christians to convert?
To try to convert. Why didn't we attempt to convert them? So there are two reasons. It's a good question. There are two reasons for this, classically. One reason is because, as a general rule, we weren't pursuers of conversion. It, generally speaking, is not part of our ideology. Remember that we begin as a family. Right, the descendants of Abraham and Sarah, and there's no real imperative to come, join our family. You're not of the family. You have the laws of Noah, which are for all of humanity, and that's good enough for you. You don't need to come in, and that's one reason. A second reason, well, actually, there are three reasons, I suppose. A second reason would be fear, self-preservation. Because the Christians didn't like it when people converted to Judaism, and we have records of this. There was a fellow in Poland in the 18th century who was actually a noble who decided to convert to Judaism, and he survived one day. And it would be dangerous to be a Jew involved in this conversion as well. So the second reason is self-preservation, and then third would be a fear of insincere conversion. Meaning that if you start encouraging people to convert and they're not really sincere about it, they can lead others astray. And so that's a concern as well. If you go back to the biblical book of Ezra, you're now talking about 2,500 years ago, the Jews come back for the Second Temple, and Ezra discovers that the Jews who have returned to the land have been marrying the nations of the land. And his solution to the problem is not to say, well, have them convert, because of fear that it's just going to be an on-paper conversion, and that will lead to dilution of Jewish practice. I think those are the three reasons why we didn't classically try to convert people. In this period of history, reason number two would have been the primary one, which is just fear. Yeah? So Ezra actually doesn't know what to do. It's a fascinating thing. I'm teaching a class on this later today. That's why it's on my mind. But Ezra doesn't know what to do. He sits down on the floor, tears his clothing, and cries when he receives the news. And then a fellow by the name of Shechaniah ben Yechiel, which is a mouthful, but Shechaniah ben Yechiel is of the Jews of that time, and he says, we are going to volunteer to separate, so that the intermarriages actually break up. Now, how many of them did that? What percentage of them did that is unclear. But this is very much Ezra's style, which is he was not someone who wanted to compel people and to coerce people. He was somebody who led by example, as opposed to saying, you must do this. Contrast that with the next leader in our history of the time, a man by the name of Nehemiah, who issued decrees and edicts and said, okay, this is what we're doing. But that wasn't really Ezra's model. Okay, so the badges varied, the color varied. Sometimes, as I noted in example in number five, it was a hat. That's actually from 13th century Austria. But it continued in those lands, Germany as well. Sometimes the hat had the brim twisted into horns. Yeah, you've heard that one. The right. That was actually, I first heard that from Rabbi Saltzman's mother. Rabbi Saltzman here? Some of you know, his mother was my teacher in second grade in New York. She was my English teacher. So she used to go out, I still remember this after quite a few years, this was 1981, but she used to go out and teach in Native American reservations during the summer. And I remember she told the stories about red deer and pemmican and all this other stuff sticks with me. But she said that when she would go out in the West, she would meet people who had never seen a Jew before and who would look for her horns. And I didn't know anything because I grew up in New York. What you're talking about. But that was what she said. That people who had never seen Jews before assumed that Jews had horns. And this is an example of it. So, what's the result? What's the impact for Jews when this is going on? When they're forced to wear a badge? Yeah.
Here you see degradation.
Degradation. A sense, certainly a sense of degradation.
Segregation,
and that's something that I actually want to emphasize here. It becomes a lot easier within Jewish communities to justify for themselves ghettoization. Right? We're already marked as being apart from society. So from a psychological perspective, it makes sense for Jews to say, you know, we want to live apart from them. Rather than have to travel among them marked by this badge or this hat or whatever it is at all times. There was a hand back here? Mm-hmm. Definitely an element of fear. It made us much more vulnerable. We're much easier to harm. You know, take a look. Actually, no, don't take a look because I didn't bring it on the sheet. I thought I did. But I knew that I was... I spent a lot of time trying to cut down on the sources, but then I ended up having another page anyway. Go figure. But in a work called History of the Jews of Poland and Russia... They point out that there was a pogrom in the town of Erfurt in the year 1221 in which 96 Jews were killed, and they were identified for murder based on the badge. That was how they knew who they should kill. It also has great impact in Jewish law, interestingly, because Jewish law has to deal with whatever's going on in society. Somebody, I gave a class on Sunday evening, and somebody after the class was talking to me about how, you know, Jews don't adapt. He's talking about Orthodoxy. Specifically, we don't adapt. We don't have a Sanhedrin. We don't have the ability to change. And I said to him, we are adapting regardless, Sanhedrin or no Sanhedrin. Yeah, we do adapt. Every new technology that comes up has to be dealt with. In the last 6 months, I've been involved in either teaching or participating in, you know, classes on issues of choosing the gender of a baby, and issues of what do you do when a baby has three mothers. Right? Because you take genetic material from one cell, you put it into another cell, you then create the embryo and implant it into a third woman. And the question is, so who's the mother now, right? If you're worried about matrilineal descent and how you define Jewish, and issues of ethics, and who is the parent, and who has parental responsibilities, and who has parental rights, you know, these are issues. You have Google Voice in your home. Are you allowed to use it on Shabbat to give orders to the room? Or even if you don't have to give orders, the room already knows. When you walk in, the room knows what temperature you want, and the room knows which lights you want on. Are you allowed to walk in the room, causing it to adjust? These are issues which, of course, we have to adapt to, and of course, we have to deal with, and many, many more. The latest one that I'm looking into now is the clean meat discussion. Right? There are two companies in Israel who are on the cutting edge, no pun intended, of the clean meat movement, in which they take cells, or they're trying to do this, take cells from an animal, clone them, and create meat. And the question is, will the meat be kosher? And will the meat be fleshek? Maybe the meat's parath. They're claiming that they will have it ready for market in a year from now. The holdup isn't the cloning problem. That's not the holdup for them in the technology. The holdup for them technologically is trying to get it to differentiate into the different textures that we associate with meat, because otherwise you just have mush. So that's really what they're working on. fascinating stuff. Anyway, my point is that with any new development, you have to adapt and you have to figure out, so where does this fit within Jewish law? How do we deal, you know, how do we deal with this? So the same thing happened with the Jewish badge, because there is a law that says that on Shabbat, I'm not supposed to carry in from a private domain into a public domain. Well, what am I supposed to do if they make me have the badge? It's not really a garment. You can say wear it, but it's not. Is it really a garment at all? Like that I could say I'm wearing? Like, for example, right? If you're familiar with this issue, you may be familiar with the question of how one transports a key, right? And so historically, Jews have taken keys and turned them into a form of jewelry to wear, and that was the way they would handle getting a key from place to place. It was a brooch, or it was a tie clip, or it was a connector for a belt. The Jews are remarkably creative. So the question was, what do they do with the badge? So take a look on your sheet. Source number 6 from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, written in Krakow, this piece of it, in number 6. Connecting an item to clothing to allow you to transport it is effective to permit it only if that item is ordinarily connected to clothing in that place. So I can't take something, you know, I want a handkerchief. I want to get my handkerchief from point A to point B. I can't say, no problem, I'll just pin it to my clothing. No one walks around with a handkerchief pinned to their clothing. That wouldn't work. So something that is not ordinarily connected in that way is forbidden. And then he says, one may travel with the green stars, which the government of Persia has decreed all Jews must bear on their garments, even if the stars are weakly linked and not sewn on. Nonetheless, he says it is okay. Tell me something. This is written, I just told you, in Krakow. How many Persians do you think Rabbi Moshe Isserles ever met? Did the government of Persia decree what they should be doing in Poland? Why did he say government of Persia? Not to be offensive, because he knows that they're going to burn his book if he says the government of Poland in any way resembling something negative. So he says the Persians have told us that we have to. Wink, wink. The same thing happens if you take a look at source number 7, moving ahead, the very beginning of the 20th century in Lithuania. Rabbi Yechiel Michel Epstein talks about the same phenomenon and the issue of attaching it to one's clothing. He had, in his day, it was about green stars that they have to wear, and that he justifies wearing. But from a Jewish law perspective, this became relevant. So it's an issue of vulnerability. It's an issue of law, of what are you going to do with these on Shabbat? And it creates a sense of being outcasts and aliens. We always had, and we're going to have to come back to this in a little bit, but we always had a sense of dressing apart. I gave you a reference from the Code of Jewish Law in source number 8, but I'm not going to read it inside. I'll explain it outside. There's a set of laws called Chukot Akum, which means the laws of the nations, literally laws of idolaters, but it isn't about idolaters per se. But this rule says that we are not supposed to imitate the dress of those around us. I'm not talking about where it's functional. Where there's a functional garment, you know, everybody's wearing, you know, down coats in the wintertime. Well, you can't wear a down coat because that's what they wear. No, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about where they have a type of garb that is not worn for a particular reason that we can identify, out of concern, sometimes, that its root is actually in idolatrous practices. Maybe the reason why they had that garment had to do with their religious beliefs, and that we don't want to emulate, but there's a basic principle of not trying to look like those around you. So we've always not wanted to look like those around us. But here, this led to Jews becoming pariahs. Take a look at source number 9. This is fascinating.
Yes. So what? How does that explain Jews, some Jews today, who dress basically like 17th or 18th century Ukrainians, royalty? I mean, I don't.
Yeah.
That this says that they shouldn't be doing that.
So it says yes and no, right? It says no in their day and yes after their day. Right? Because now they look different. No one's going to confuse them for anybody else.
But Rabbi, what about Popov, who are...
But that's their question. Right. That's what she's asking about. Kapata, Bekish, Ashtrimal, and so on.
The White Sox.
The White Sox. The, athletes also wear white socks. But yes. You mean the Vishnitzers who put the socks over the pants.
Yes.
Yeah. The, so the, but the answer to the question is that, in fact, there are those who specifically will wear a long coat instead of, let's say, a suit jacket, because they feel that this way they're marked as being different. They're not looking like the nations who are around them. Did they start wearing this when royalty in their area wore it? That's a very good question. Even so, it probably would have been justified as we're supposed to wear nice clothing for Shabbat, because that's really when it was primarily worn, and this is what constitutes nice in the area in which we live. But there's always been this tension of, you know, not wanting to masquerade as those around us, not trying to pass to be taken for those around us, and this actually fit very well. But the difference is when you choose it for yourself versus when somebody imposes it upon you. Right, that's the question, and I don't know the answer. It could be, again, for Shabbat and Yom Tov, for the holidays, maybe they would have, because it's what constitutes nice clothing, but I'm not sure. I think one more question and then move on, because we're going to run out of time. There's a lot to say still.
I'm not going to be a question, so I think, would you ask me to?
Go ahead.
Is the business of badges really is helping us, in a way, to congregate and be something like a ghetto now, because we like to be together, and that gave us the base of being stronger. And I think this is a...
So I'm going to come back. It's a very important point. I'm going to come back to that in about 30 seconds, because I think it's a crucial point to note. I know other people have things to say, but I'm going to just ask to hold off for a bit, because there are certain things I want to make sure to get to. Take a look at number 9, Israel Abrams, Jewish Life in the Middle Ages. He says, the effects produced by this system of branding the Jews as a pariah class were as deplorable as they were inevitable. The Jew became the mark for the meanest of insults. Beaten, reviled, scorned, abused by everyone, he was made to swallow abuse like water. He was not allowed to take offense at anything. He lost his old refinements. Of old, no people had paid more attention to accuracy and polish in speech, to decency and cleanliness in dress, to self-respect in their manners and bearing. In other words, if you are excluded from society and treated as a nothing, so that's right, that it gets drummed into you, it becomes part of your psyche. And the result is, as Israel Abrams views it, that we move away from that society, their language, their manners, and instead we try to strengthen ourselves internally. There's an explosion of Jewish texts at this point, where we try to reinforce who we are and our identity at this stage in our national existence, and we gain the sense that secular authority is something to be avoided, thwarted, bribed, and overcome. Yeah, anything just to avoid what they're going to try to do to us. And that suspicion of civil authority continues down to this day in Jewish communities. The sense that they must be out to get us, they must be out to harm us, and the legitimization of doing what we can to thwart them begins there, because look what they are to us. They're the people who come along and try to make us less than. They try to degrade us and make us into outcasts. Why in the world should I be loyal to their system? And of course, you can't say this without noting that it leads to the 20th century yellow star. Right? You can't skip that point. I gave you a reference in source number 10 to an excellent article on this. But of particular note, April 1st, 1933, when the Nazis declare a boycott upon Jewish stores, yellow stars of David were painted on the windows of Jewish stores by individuals. In other words, it wasn't government issued. At that point, the Nazis hadn't even begun to discuss the Jewish badge in April of 1933. But Europeans knew this. This was their heritage of having the Jews marked as being set aside, as being apart, as being different. There was a German Zionist leader by the name of Robert Welch at the time who wrote an article which translated into English. The title is "Wear the Yellow Badge with Pride." And then, you know, obviously that goes by the wayside once the Nazis turned that into their policy. But this is a little bit of background on the badge itself. Where it came from, what its impact was, some of its forms, But I want to go back to that note from the Lateran Council, from the Fourth Lateran Council, where they connected it to the tzitzit, to those strings, right? The strings I'm talking about, you see the corner of a garment, these don't have a blue string, but that's what we're talking about. So if you take a look on your sheet at source number 11, this is the passage they're referring to. From Numbers, it's from this week's Torah portion. God says to Moses, "Speak to the children of Israel and bid them that they make them fringes in the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and that they put upon the fringe of each corner a thread of tehillah." This is the translation of the Koran edition. All translations that you see will be roughly similar. "And it shall be to you as a fringe, that you may look upon it and remember all the commandments of God and do them, and that you seek not after your own heart and your own eyes, after which you go astray, that you may remember and do all my commandments and be holy to your God." So what's the message of the tzitzit? Is the tzitzit mitzvah here in number 11, these fringes, is it about looking different? No. Right, it's personal, and it's about your relationship with God. Take a look at number 12. The Talmud actually states it. The Talmud actually states it in number 12. Rabbi Meir asked, "Why do we want this tchelet, bluish color, specifically? It resembles the sea. The sea resembles the heavens. The heavens resemble the divine throne." And he quotes you a verse from Exodus about seeing sapphire in the heavens. That's a goal, is in order to be reminded of God. There's another passage from the Talmud that speaks about it in terms of surrounding us with mitzvot, so that the Jew who wears this is surrounded by mitzvot. Now, some of you may note, perhaps we're about to tell me, that you know this is traditionally worn by men, right? I knew it was coming. And that is indeed true. That is traditionally worn by men. It's considered an obligation for males. Why only for males? Because it's considered a time-bound commandment, in the sense that it's a daytime commandment specifically, at the time when you can see it. And generally speaking, women have been exempted from mitzvot that were linked to a particular moment in time for their fulfillment. It's often explained that the exemption is because during the years of pregnancy and then birthing children and then nursing children, requiring them to stick to a particular schedule of what to do when is foolish. Maybe that's the reason. Don't know. But in any case, that's why women were classically considered to be exempt from it. Yes. Yes. I've never seen it, but it's possible. Whether somebody could be wearing tzitzit that are not white. So the answer actually is that there was even a practice of wearing tzitzit strings that had the same color as the garment that the person was wearing. So there's even a group in Israel now that's trying to produce camouflage tzitzit for soldiers. Because if they wear the strings out, you don't want to have a problem. So they're producing camouflage strings for the soldiers. Although that does kind of defy the whole visibility element, doesn't it? Nonetheless, battlefield? Yeah. So the idea is, if you take a look at source number 13, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, he says, "Thus, when the sensitive eye and the sensitive heart of man wander out into the visible world and are then thrown back upon themselves," when you look at yourself, "they find the human garment, the first visible characteristic distinguishing man from beast, reminding man of his superiority over brutishness and making him aware of the existence of the invisible one and his word, and recalling vividly God, human dignity, and the mission of Israel." So the clothing will be the marker. However, even though tzitzit was not really about marking us as being different from others, it's true that when it comes to dress, we mark ourselves as separate from others. I mentioned to you before already the practice of not dressing like the nations. I also brought you on your sheet in number 14, where Jacob has to dress up as his brother Esau, right, in order to fool his father, and how uncomfortable that is for him and as a memory for the Jewish people. The idea of fooling somebody with our dress is not what we want. And in general, in Judaism, we do have that feeling of standing apart. There's a tension of being part of humanity and not being part of humanity at the same time. There's a passage in the Talmud which I brought you in source number 16 which emphasizes the importance of being part of society. So we support the needy of the nations just like we support our own needy. We visit the ill whether they're Jewish or not Jewish. We take care of their burials whether they're Jewish or they're not Jewish. We may have a separate cemetery, that's its own discussion. But the point is that we take care of the world. We don't say we're just going to look after our own and not take care of everybody. We need to promote a society in which everybody is taken care of and gets along. At the same time, it's true that we stand apart. I brought you this passage in number 17 in which there's a reunion of Jacob and his brother Esau. After all the enmity and the hatred and Esau wanted to kill him, there's a reunion. And Esau says to him, isn't this great? We're getting along. Let's go travel together. And Jacob finds any excuse he can not to go. He says, well, you know, my children are young, and we have sheep and cattle, it won't really work. And Esau says, oh, that's okay, I'm willing to go along with you. And Jacob says, well, you know, why would you want to do that? And Esau, in the end, goes his own way, and Jacob says, I'll catch up with you later, which he doesn't. There is this, on the one hand, wanting to be part of society, and the other hand, wanting to withdraw. A fellow by the name of Bilam will be described in the Torah portion in a couple of weeks. Bilam was a sorcerer of sorts who was hired to curse the Jews in an attempt to battle us when we were on our way from Egypt into Israel. He's hired by a conglomerate, two nations, Midian and Moab. He tries to curse the Jews, and as the story is recorded biblically, every time he opens his mouth to curse us, instead a blessing comes out. And this is one of the things he said in source number 18. He describes the Jews as a people who dwells alone. In Hebrew, Am Levadad Yishkon. A people who dwells alone, who will not be numbered among the nations. And he views that as a good thing. That we are marked as unique and separate, not in a bad way, but in a positive way. And that's something which we have upheld in various ways. If you take a look at source number 19, I'm going a little bit quickly here because I think that we are at time. But Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik wrote the following in 1967. 1967 was a very important year in many ways. Obviously, we were dealing with the 50th anniversary, unification of Jerusalem, the Six-Day War. But separate from that, actually, that was also when the Vatican issued Vatican II, as it's called. When they decided that, they were willing to have dialogue with us, that we were not going to be treated as inferior. And, you know, that's sort of, you know, gone its own way in the last 50 years, sometimes better, sometimes worse. But take a look at source number 19, where Rabbi Soloveitchik writes a response to the issue of interfaith dialogue. He says, we cooperate with the members of other faith communities in all fields of constructive human endeavor, like the ones in number 16 above. But simultaneously with our integration into the general social framework, we engage in a movement of recoil and retrace our steps. In a word, we belong to the human society and at the same time we feel as strangers and outsiders. We do stand alone, even as we want to be part of the world. The difference between our standing alone, though, and the badge is that we want it to be our choice. We don't want it to be something that is imposed upon us from the outside. The badge may well have had, as someone mentioned before, a positive element to it, not by their design, but by the fact that it did reinforce our standing alone, but not in the way that we wanted. We wanted it to be our decision to do so. And I conclude with source number 20, a fascinating midrash. It notes that there are multiple times in the Torah when we are described as being alone. Three times that this word badad is used to describe our being alone. And it says, alone, we are to be alone, not like Bilam's alone, which was in number 19. They are a people who dwells alone. We don't want to be alone because Bilam says we're going to be alone. And not like Jeremiah's alone in the beginning of the book of Echa, Lamentations. How has she come to dwell alone, talking about Jerusalem? But like Moses's alone, because Moses also described us as being alone, where he used the term, God will guide them alone. Hashem badad yanchenu. That God will guide us alone. When it's an alone that's a function of our identity as opposed to something imposed, then it's a positive. We've known both in our history. I hope that it will be the one that we choose as opposed to the one that's imposed upon us. I wish you a wonderful summer, and I look forward to seeing you in September. Thank you.